ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 14, texts number 9 through 21. I'd like to welcome our two guests here and apologize. You stepped into the postgraduate studies. And so we'll just kind of let you float along as opposed to try to bring you up to speed. But we'll open it up for questions at the end, and those around you can kind of help you fill in the spaces. So we'll start with text 9 and just read the translations all the way through to text 21 in unison. From him only, all our kingly opulence, good wives, lives, progeny, control over our subjects, victory over our enemies, and future accommodations in higher planets have become possible. All this is due to his causeless mercy upon us. Just see, O man with a tiger's strength, how many miseries due to celestial influences, earthly reactions, and bodily pains, all very dangerous in themselves, are foreboding danger in the near future by deluding our intelligence. The left side of my body, my thighs, arms, and eyes are all quivering again and again. I am having heart palpitations due to fear. All this indicates undesirable things. Just see, O Bhima, how the she-jackal cries at the rising sun and vomits fire, how the dogs bark at me fearlessly. O Bhima Sen, tiger among men, now useful animals like cows are passing me on my left side, and lower animals like the asses are circumambulating me. My horses appear to be weeping upon seeing me. Just see, the pigeon is like a messenger of death. The shrieks of the owl and their rival crows make my heart tremble. It appears that they want to make a void of the whole universe. Just see how the smoke encircles the sky. It appears that the earth and mountains are throbbing. Just like the cloudless thunder, the wind blows violently, blasting dust everywhere and creating darkness. Clouds are raining everywhere with bloody disasters. The rays of the sun are declining, and the stars appear to be fighting amongst themselves. Confused living entities appear to be ablaze and weeping. Rivers, tributaries, ponds, reservoirs, and the mind are all perturbed. Butter no longer ignites fire. What is the extraordinary time? What is going to happen? The calves do not suck the teats of the cows, nor do the cows give milk. They are standing, crying, tears in their eyes, and the bulls take no pleasure in the pasturing grounds. The deities seem to be crying in the temple, lamenting and perspiring. They seem about to leave. All the cities, villages, towns, gardens, mines, and hermitages are now devoid of beauty and bereft of all happiness. I do not know what sort of calamities are now awaiting us. I think that all these earthly disturbances indicate some greater loss to the good fortune of the world. The world is fortunate enough to have been marked with the footprints of the lotus feet of the Lord. These signs indicate that this will be no longer. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Chapter is entitled The Disappearance of Lord Krishna. And this section of this chapter, we're dealing with Yudhishthira Maharaj's knowledge of what's going on. Made me think of, some of you may be familiar, there's this commercial for 4G. And it's these two guys, and someone comes and says something, up, oh, 3 seconds ago. Someone says, oh, you know, something, up, oh, up, oh, so 4 seconds ago. In other words, they're looking for immediate information. Now, Yudhishthira Maharaj doesn't have that type of assistance, if you will. He has a much greater assistance. He's what we call throughout the Bhagavatam a Raja Rishi, a king who is also a saintly person. an individual who is not simply a ruler, as Prabhupada said, by vox populi, as we are now in the... It seems like in this country we're always in the middle of an election. The minute one finishes, they start up for the next one. So we've still got a year ahead of us or something. But anyway, these people are spending vast millions of dollars just to get into a post so that they can supposedly be the leader of the universe, leader of the world at any rate. But this isn't the way that the leadership of personalities like Yudhishthira Maharaj is described. Rajarishi means that they have a spiritual vision based on their religious principles. You would be very hard-pressed to find religious principles of any of the personalities currently trying to acquire the office of leader of the country. And the qualities of Yudhishthira Maharaj here, if you even study just briefly, very, very spiritual in their nature. So this type of consciousness, this allows him to be able to understand the surrounding circumstances that he finds himself in and to ascertain exactly what they mean in a very factual way. Now, of course, he does have the added benefit of the association of sadhus, personalities like Narada Muni, who have already given a little warning to the Pandavas, you know, things are about to change. Krishna is soon going to be leaving. So then when Yudhishthira sees all of these different calamities, which we've just read and we'll go through this morning, he is very clearly able to put them together. The thing that sets it off, though, as we described in the last few verses leading up to this, is the absence of Arjuna. Arjuna is the greatest of warriors. Arjuna is always successful in his activities. Arjuna is always accomplished in whatever he sets out to fulfill. Arjuna's been gone for a very long time, much longer than expected. He simply went to Dwarka to inquire what's going on and come back. And the time frame that's elapsed has been much greater than it should have been. And then all of these omens, if you will, begin to be noticed by Yudhishthira, and he starts adding two and two together. And he's a very good mathematician. He comes up with four. And he realizes that the words of Narada are about to take place. Now, in this particular set of verses here, he's speaking to Bhima. It's a rare section of the Bhagavatam. You don't usually find conversations between Yudhishthira and Bhima. And I like the way he, of course, you know, they're brothers and great devotees, both of them. I like the way twice in the verses here, he uses the analogy of a tiger in describing Bhima. Naravagra and Purusha Vyagra. Tiger amongst men. And what is the exact? And tiger, a man with tiger's strength. Oh, tiger amongst men, and oh, man with tiger's strength. Of course, we could spend an entire class going on about the tiger-like strength of Bhima, the different qualities and activities. But let's just suffice it to say he's being appropriately described like this because the tiger is very strong. Actually, one time Srila Prabhupada was, I may have told this story before, but. One time Srila Prabhupada was discussing with some of the disciples that were preaching in Africa in the early days. And they explained to him that in some of the tribal regions, the qualification is if a young man wanted to be married, then in order to prove himself as a capable man, he had to go out with just a spear and fight a tiger and kill it. And then that proved he was qualified. Prabhupada chuckled and said, yes, this should be what our brahmacharis have to do before they get married. So, to have the strength of a tiger is, you know, pointed out here as being very, very significant. And this is how he describes Bhima. And he's taking Bhima into confidence, both as a brother and as a fellow devotee. You know, sometimes you see a scenario, be it uplifting or a difficult situation, and then you talk about it with your close associates, you know. You know, this situation of observed this is certainly indicates this is happening or that's happening. You know, in our mundane circumstances, this generally degrades itself down to what is commonly called gossip. One of my favorite words, kukata. This is from the third canto of the Bhagavatam. Kukata means bad words. And in the Sanskrit of that verse, the other word used is matigni. It means words that kill the intelligence. And just a couple of verses. The next verse up here, we see that these things, the phrase used is deluding our intelligence. We'll get to that in a minute. So at any rate, this purport to this first verse, number 9, is very, very nice. I wanted to go through it because I felt the entire purport was quite appropriate. Material prosperity consists of a good wife, good home, sufficient land, good children, aristocratic family relations, victory over competitors, and, by pious work, attainment of accommodations in the higher celestial planets for better facilities of material amenities. These facilities are earned not only by one's hard manual labor or by unfair means, but by the mercy of the Supreme Lord. Prosperity earned by one's personal endeavor also depends on the mercy of the Lord. Personal labor must be there in addition to the Lord's benediction. But without the Lord's benediction, no one is successful simply by their personal labor. The modernized man of Kali Yuga believes in personal endeavor and denies the benediction of the Supreme Lord. Even a great sannyasi of India delivered speeches in Chicago protesting the benedictions of the Supreme Lord. But as far as Vedic Shastras are concerned, as we find in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam, the ultimate sanction for all success rests in the hands of the Supreme Lord. Maharaj Yudhishthira admits this truth in his personal success, and it behooves one to follow in the footsteps of a great king and devotee of the Lord to make life a full success. If one can achieve success without the satisfaction of the Lord, then no medical practitioner would fail to cure a patient. Despite the most advanced treatment of a suffering patient by the most up-to-date medical practitioner, there is death. And even in the most hopeless case without medical treatment, a patient is cured astonishingly. Therefore, the conclusion is that God's sanction is the immediate cause for all happenings, good or bad. A successful man should be grateful to the Lord for all he has achieved. I've mentioned before in many different scenarios that the family I come from, my brothers, are all very adamant Christians. I think sometimes the word fanatical is used, but we'll say adamant for this assembly. And they very much stress on me when the subject of karma comes up that your activities, your work has nothing to do with it because of a particular verse from the Bible, which I'm unfamiliar with the exact reference, but it alludes to the fact that man does not succeed by work alone. And therefore, only by the mercy of God do we get. Therefore, karma cannot have any relevance. Here in these few short sentences, Srila Prabhupada very clearly gives the understanding. No, it's not just by your karma, because if it were only by your karma, then there'd be no concern of the presence of the personality of Godhead. It would simply be whatever my work is, whatever endeavor, whatever personal labor I perform, that will give me what I achieve. Now, I know this isn't true because in the circumstance of my work environment, I work just as hard as the guy just across the aisle from me in a different department, and he sells twice as much as I do. Now, how is that possible if it's all karma? Because we're both endeavoring just the same. Prabhupada says you see two people working side by side. One achieves great wealth and one struggles just to maintain their monthly expenses. So karma obviously is not the entire scenario. The other side of the coin is that, oh, everything is by the grace of God. Therefore, I'll simply sit here and if God wants me to have it, it will come. Now, there is one type of sannyasi like that. That simply, what is the Python man, yes. Simply sat there and whatever came, this is in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, whatever came he accepted and whatever didn't come, that was fine. So there is a place for that as well. But the factual predicament of all of our lives is that it's a combination of these two factors. That by the mercy of the Lord and by the endeavor that we make, there we get our successes or failures. That it's not an exclusive thing of one or the other. So this combination of these two is how we can go about our life in a peaceful manner. We have to make some endeavor, but that endeavor has to be blessed by the Lord because the endeavor is within the sanctions and the arrangement of the Lord. with his instructions. That's what the whole purpose of Shastra is there for, to give us guideline, to give us practical information how to execute these activities, how to make that personal endeavor so that we are eligible for his blessings. Now, I found it interesting how Prabhupada mentions so-called sannyasi, a great sannyasi, actually even calls him a great sannyasi. The reference here is to Vivekananda in 1893. And what I found interesting about this is, Prabhupada was barely around at this point, but obviously the teachings of Vivekananda, anybody that knows the history of impersonalism in India, are very, very profound. In Chicago in 1893, Vivekananda was born in 1863. And in 1893, he was brought to America by the Parliament of World Religions for a lecture he delivered in Chicago. And you can actually go on YouTube and listen to that lecture. They have a recording of it. The point, huh? Yeah, it's recorded. Yeah. So at any rate, in that lecture, Vivekananda denies the presence of the mercy of God. That is, by our endeavor. It's what you would expect from an impersonalist. And this presentation was what most Western, particularly American people, knew as Hinduism for centuries. No, I'm sorry, not centuries. For at least a few decades until Srila Prabhupada came. And so this idea of man creating his own destiny is very much the type of preaching that Vivekananda presented in his tour. I found it interesting in reading up on this that Vivekananda came to America in 83, stayed till 95, and after 2 years of traveling was just totally exhausted, just couldn't keep up. Prabhupada traveled for 12 years. You know, 2 years in the can, and he just couldn't do it anymore. And also, he was a classic example of what Prabhupada refused, even though he was encouraged by other associates in his early days, of taking up the Western dress and the Western ideas and the Western eating habits, all of these things. Prabhupada never did any of this stuff and was extremely more successful than any of these personalities. Anyway, then Srila Prabhupada goes on to a statement here which... Of course, I was very realized in my own circumstance that speaking about the medical practitioner in hopeless cases, many of you are familiar with the circumstances with my daughter just a couple of years ago. The medical people had no expectation of her surviving the surgery that she had to undergo and of any expectation of her being out of the hospital anytime under 6 months. And you know, word went out to the Vaishnava community worldwide, and thanks to so many devotees, so many different pujas were performed, and kirtans were offered in her name, and 6 weeks later she walked out the front door of the hospital, completely astonishing the doctors how it was even possible. So this is another example how the grace of the Lord has to be there present in one's life. And how does one acquire that grace, one may ask? By the mercy of the Vaishnavas. This is completely exemplified by this. So Prabhupada finishes this purport off with a very, very wonderful sentence. Any successful person should feel grateful to the Lord for all that he has achieved. The nature of material energy is that we're always ungrateful and always hankering for more, hankering and lamenting. We're hankering to acquire something, and as soon as we acquire it, we lament the fact that I may lose it. So this is the pushings of the material energy, the material nature, material desires. We're never satisfied. And so a successful person in these things, and Prabhupada states clearly here what success is considered materially, good wife, good husband, whichever the case may be, good home, sufficient land, good children, aristocratic family relations, victory over one's competitors as a salesman. I'm very appreciative of that note. And by pious work, accommodations for the higher celestial planets. So all of those things right there, everybody would aspire to have if they want to be materially successful. If one acquires those, then one should be grateful to the Lord. But we don't always see that that's the circumstance. So, moving on to this next verse here, text number 10. It brought to mind, Prabhupada's listing three things here. How many miseries due to celestial influences, earthly reactions, and bodily pains? Who can tell me another way that these are described and what we also know them as? Yes, and what are those? Yes, adiatmic, adibodic, and adidaivic, which fits with these suggestions in this verse here. Adidaivic, the higher living entities, the circumstances of the demigods, so the celestial influences. Adibodic, other living entities, circumstances in this world. And adiatmic, those caused by our own circumstances, our own body, the bodily pains. And Prabhupada mentions these are all very dangerous within themselves. Very dangerous within themselves. And they are indicative of future difficulties. Why? Because they delude our intelligence. This is an interesting point. Many of you here are attending the university, and the whole purpose of university is to expand our intelligence, to increase our intelligence. Of course, you have the University of the Krishna House, which there should be a little... University of the Krishna House. And this is the real expansion of intelligence beyond just the mundane, occupational intelligence that we require in this world. The presence of these difficulties, when we absorb ourselves in them and when we are not able to look past them, as Prabhupada says here, deludes our intelligence. We become sidetracked. We become preoccupied with birth, death, old age, disease, with the different types of sufferings. And as a result of that, we're not able to stay focused. Now, in this particular purport here, we'll just kind of jump into it. Prabhupada says the celestial influences include, and he lists them here, excessive heat, excessive cold, rain or no rain, after effects of famine, disease, epidemic. Now, if we look around the world circumstances as we see it nowadays, the alarmists, they like to profess the coming of Armageddon or Mayan calendar, whatever your particular flavor of doomsday philosophy is. And you have a variety of people that are always predicting that, oh, the earth's going to end, the world's going to finish on such and such date or such and such time, and all these indications show that it's like that. The fact of the matter is, there's nothing new about any of this. I mean, the circumstance of this world is constantly fraught with all of these different dangers. The very existence of the adiatmic, adibodhic, and adidaivic is a danger. The very existence of ourselves in this world, the soul is eternal and aspires for an eternal circumstance. The body and the circumstances of living in this world in the body are all temporary. And therefore, it's a very dangerous situation. There's actually no way that we can be satisfied here. No way that we can feel peaceful, that we can feel protected. A person's at peace of mind when they feel they have a situation where they're protected, where they can easily execute the activities that they require to execute, and where they feel safe. There's no way we can feel that way trying to live in a temporary circumstance with an eternal nature. There's always going to be some difficulty in that way. Prabhupada discusses that, the idea is that when we have these types of circumstances that everybody, either personally or on a community level or a national level or a global level, wants to combat these with different, how does Prabhupada say, stopgap measures, different arrangements, whatever the particular circumstance, and they're all listed here, there are so many different ways to try and adjust those. But the real adjustment is to absorb ourselves in spiritual consciousness, because these things are not going to change. There's always going to be excessive cold or excessive heat. There's always going to be too much rain or too little rain. All of these difficulties will be there. But if we can adjust our consciousness, which is not affected by these things directly, we actually don't control these influences, these weather-related, these circumstances. But what we can control is our consciousness and those things that affect our consciousness and how we let them affect our consciousness. So this is where we can actually get the relief, by changing our particular consciousness. So, we read all these things. It sounds terribly depressing. So, what's the poor jiva to do? The plight of the poor jiva, Save the whales, what's the other things they're saving? The polar bears, the gray wolves. What about this poor suffering jiva? Somebody save the jiva. Well, Prabhupada's saving us. And how are we to be saved? Right here, the end of this, Prabhupada says it very simply. They can simply be overcome. They, referring to these three disturbances, adiatmic, adibodhic, and adidaivic, can simply be overcome by one who surrenders fully in devotion under the lotus feet of the Lord. Now, right before that, Prabhupada gives a warning. The Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, verse 14, clearly states that the reaction of material energy is never to be conquered. Can't be done. You cannot overcome all of these difficulties that go along with the material world. It's just not possible. We, the minute, fragmental jiva inhabiting this body, even collectively, cannot overcome the influences of material energy. They're very powerful. They're represented in the personified form, of course, as Maya. Prabhupada mentions right here. They're represented by Maya. And Maya is the pure devotee of the Lord. And the pure devotee of the Lord has great potency, access to great power, and great influence. Now, we, the suffering living entity, the embodied jiva, cannot possibly beat that. You know, we can't come up against it and win. Therefore, we have to have someone on our side. We have to have someone who's got our best interest in mind. And Prabhupada indicates clearly here, taking devotional service as our shelter, taking shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, gives us that edge. You know, whenever there's a sports competition, you know, a big game, you know, because, you know, we live here in the university town and the Gators and big game, they've always got an edge, you know, particular player that's going to save the game, you know. And so for us, the struggling living entity trying to make our foothold in devotional service, this is our edge, to have the shelter of the spiritual master and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, one thing I thought of when Prabhupada says here, fully surrender. In the earlier part of the Bhagavatam, and in the conclusion of the Battle of Kukshetra, the Brahmastra weapon is thrown. This is the equivalent, those of you that are familiar with the atomic weapon. This is thrown by Ashwatthama. Unjustly so, inappropriately so, we won't go into all that. Fact of the matter is, the Brahmastra weapon is uttered by mantra, and it's totally devastating, just as much as an atomic weapon. So, the Brahmastra weapon is coming, and what does Arjuna do? Now, Arjuna, lion amongst men, so many descriptions are given in the Bhagavad Gita that allude to his powerful position as a great warrior, as a great kshatriya. And what does he do? He bows down. That process of bowing down allows it to just sweep over him, and he's unaffected by it. So I used to work in a circumstance where a friend of mine would remind me, you know, sometimes you just have to take the position of Arjuna during the Brahmastra and just put your head down. Let things just go past you. So at any rate, this is the process of surrender, because it takes humility. Not everybody has the humility to bow down. Not everybody has the humility to admit their inferiority. And not an inferiority negatively. What's that famous statement from Peter Berwash? Humility doesn't mean that you think less of yourself. It just means you think of yourself. No, humility doesn't mean you think less of yourself. You just think of yourself less. Tricky there if you get that. So in the same way, to submit oneself, to surrender, to be humble in that way is not necessarily a shortcoming. It's actually a source of strength, because it gives one a very particular insight to a circumstance by removing themselves from being the person, you know, like that. So what have we got here? Is it this verse? Let me just catch up with my... Yes, in the next verse here. Yudhishthira begins to list these things and immediately caught my attention, because my eye has been quivering off and on for the last week, so I'm wondering, what am I up for? So, heart palpitations, they say, oh, just give him some particular medicine, that'll clear that up. No, this is all much more subtle than that. At any rate, Prabhupada goes on here talking about these things come and go just like the fires in the forest. Nobody sets them, but you know, they happen by the friction of the different branches against each other. And it reminded me that when they have these big fires, like just in the last couple of years, they've had some very major fires in the western part of the United States, you know, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of acres burned. And the first thing that happens when these fires go up, what do? They just hope and pray for rain, because it's the only thing that will actually allow them to conquer this fire. Because here again, material energy, little people, they can't control this fire. But if those higher forces, Adi Daivik, the celestial beings, the rain comes, that can actually, you know, put everything out. So Prabhupada mentions here that the fire can only be extinguished by the mercy of the Lord, who sends clouds to pour water on the fire. Similarly, and this is where Prabhupada's expertise in drawing everything back to our struggles in devotional service. Similarly, undesirable happenings in life cannot be checked by any number of plans. Such miseries can be removed only by the mercy of the Lord, who sends his bona fide representatives to enlighten human beings and thus save them from all calamities. Only the guru has the shelter that can bring us to the protection of the personality of Godhead, the passcode, if you will. You want to access a computer program nowadays, you've got to have various passcodes. Can't get in unless you get the password. And you can fiddle around and try and, you know, all different things, but unless someone comes and gives you that, oh, then you get the entrance. So the same way, the access to the shelter of devotional service is given by the guru. There's that famous verse, Yasya Deva Pura Bhaktir, Yata Deva Tata Guru, that only by unflinching faith to the spiritual master and Krishna are these secrets revealed. I have a few verses here on the importance of spiritual master, and I wanted to share these. This is from some old study material I have that I came across here. Just that one. Jeve shakshat nahitat guru chetarupe shiksha guru haya krishna mahanta sarupe. Since one cannot usually experience the presence of the supersoul, he, the Lord, appears before us as a liberated devotee, such as the spiritual master, and no one other, such a spiritual master is no one other than Krishna himself. So this is how Krishna appears to us, to give us his opportunity for devotional service as the spiritual master. Tato du shangamushtrija satsu sanjeta burimam shantu evas yachindanti mano vyasangam uttibi. One should therefore avoid bad company and associate only with devotees of the Lord. With their realized instructions, one can cut the knot connecting one with the activities unfavorable to devotional service. So these difficulties described in this chapter, the circumstances that we find ourselves in, how do we get free from them? By associating with those personalities who have the ability to help us cut that. Now, does this mean they literally give us a knife to do? No, it means that the verbal strength of words gives us that power to free ourselves from those binds of the material energy by removing that deluded intelligence. Intelligence is how we promote ourselves forward. In the university, we acquire intelligence and knowledge, and we get our degree. In any business circumstance, you acquire knowledge of your product, and that allows you to sell it better. In the same way, by having knowledge of devotional service, we're able to free ourselves from that influence of the material circumstance. Another one here. The spiritually powerful message of Godhead can be properly discussed only in the society of devotees, and it is greatly pleasing to hear in that association. If one hears from such devotees, the ways of transcendental experience quickly open to one, and gradually such a person attains a taste for knowledge that is in due course developed into attraction and devotional service. And the last one I have here. A great learned devotee, although there are many faults, although there are many faults in this material world, there is one good opportunity, and that is the association of devotees. Such association brings about great happiness. Due to this one quality, our strong desire to achieve liberation by merging with the Brahma Jyoti will be weakened and devotional service will be established. So this association with a saintly person, association with an advanced devotee, the spiritual master, will give us that opportunity to move ourselves out of this particular binds, the circumstances like that. Now, there's these next few verses go on about the different types of calamities. And anyone that has had the opportunity in their previous years to partake of any of these type of theatrical films that are, you know, doomsday presentations or, you know, ominous circumstances, things like this are very common because they understand that this is unnatural. Cloudless thunder. There's no clouds in the sky, but you hear thunder. This is not a good sign. Or you see lightning where there's a nice blue sky. These things are all indicative of calamities because they're out of the normal. They're not the way things generally function. And when you have a collection of these all together, as these verses describe, this one here, winds blowing violently, I was reminded that, I think it was just 2 or 3 days ago, huge windstorms out in Alachua. And when you drive from the temple to my house, there's one dirt road that many devotees live down. And it's a notorious road to have to drive on because you're guaranteed when you get off that road, your car will be white, even if it wasn't, just to do all the dust. But there was a dust storm coming across, and there's about 20 or 30 acres right adjacent to that. And the dust was so thick, you could see maybe 100 feet into the road, but then you couldn't see into, beyond, or through this huge dark dust cloud. Very dangerous if you happen to be driving in that. Very easy to get lost if you're out in, you know, somewhere walking in that circumstance. So this is one of those situations that are described as, you know, being very inauspicious, not being very beneficial. And then my favorite here, butter no longer ignites the fire. If you're a Purohit, this is your greatest fear, the fire doesn't light. I've done one or two where the fire it's just not going to start. This does not speak very well to the Purohit's expertise, nor does it speak very well to the auspiciousness of the occasion. So, you know, things such as that, you know, list of these here. It then goes on, one of the last things it describes is the cows. Of course, we know that in Brahminical Vedic culture, the cows are very much revered. They're compared to just like the mother. Cows give the milk. The bulls plow the fields like the mother and father, and therefore they're to be respected as one would respect the mother and father. So what is the purpose of the calf? The calf is greatly happy when it is taking the milk from the mother. It's actually stated that if in the morning hours, as your day's beginning, if you see a calf suckling from a mother cow, this is very auspicious and you'll have a nice day, you know, good blessings. I'm very fortunate on my drive to work each morning. I pass two different fields of cows, and very regularly I see cows taking their milk like that. So it's all going to be a good day. And then what is the pleasure of the cow to give that milk? Very satisfied. Cows are so happy when their calves come and they're able to give such nice milk like that. So here it's described that the calves aren't taking milk, the cows aren't able to give it. Very inauspicious. And the bulls, what is the enjoyment of the bull? The bull likes to do two things. Likes to work in the fields. This is what the bull likes to do. And to have union with the cows. So this is what the bull does in the pasturing grounds. To work and to have union with the cow. No pleasure in that. The bulls aren't doing this. So these are very inauspicious things. Now, the next verse here. The deities in the temple seem to be lamenting, crying, perspiring as if they are about to leave. The immediate thought that came to my mind was just after the time of the six Goswamis in Vrindavan, Krishnadas Kaviraj has departed, Rup Sanatan, Raghunath Bhatta, they've all left this world now. And we're not quite into the full time of Vishwanath Chakravarti. It's just in between that period of time there, and the Muslims are conquering. They've invaded in northern India, and now they've worked their way down, and they've come into the Braj area. And in the Islamic faith, the worship of idols is very much prohibited. as to the point of that, we won't go into, but this is what their faith is. So they come to Vrindavan, and they go to all the temples with the intent of destroying all the deities. Now, the deities all leave prior to their arrival. Different pujaris take them, and the king of Jaipur, who has a very strong army, Rajasthan, Kshatriyas, many of the deities go to Jaipur and protected there in the fort city. And the invasion is never successful in Jaipur. And some of the pujaris, having not had that opportunity, they bury the deities in the ground, they put them in the bottom of kuns, and in this way the deities are protected. But they all leave the different various temples. And then, of course, over the course of time, different personalities go and these deities are returned and, you know, like that. It's a very, very nice history like that. But even within our ISKCON society, I remember there was one particular temple where there was an unfortunate fire. And they were wood Gornitai deities and they were burned up in the fire. Well, very inauspicious circumstances like that. So these are all the different situations that Yudhishthira Maharaj is seeing about him. And being a advanced devotee, being an exalted personality, he is able to understand that these do not indicate very good future for us. That this is, some calamity is waiting ahead for us. And Krishna's leaving. And you can just imagine, these are personalities, Yudhishthira, Bhima, Arjuna, that have had the direct association with Krishna. All throughout their lives, they've been Krishna's associates. And the pain that must be present in their heart as they understand that Krishna is about to depart this world. It reminded me of the sorrowful condition of the residents of Navadvip after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu departed. When Narottam Das Thakur was traveling after he left Vrindavan, being trained by Jiva Goswami, and returned to Katori and was very royally received there. Then he went on pilgrimage, and he went to Navadvip. And the description of the city of Navadvip as he entered it after the Lord's departure is just a pitiful condition. The residents were barely keeping themselves alive. There was no bliss and joy of the birthplace of the Lord, and no satisfaction. Matter of fact, it describes that one of the only reasons some of the senior associates of the Lord were sticking around was just to see Narottam. Because as you may be well aware, Narottam's appearance had been predicted by Mahaprabhu with great enthusiasm. So many of these older residents were simply waiting for Narottam to show up. Then, okay, now I can leave this world. And the ecstatic joy that permeated every inch of Navadvip during Mahaprabhu's Leela is now completely gone. It's almost like a ghost town. People are so bereft. This is the joy of service of the Lord in separation. It's a little hard for us to understand that, but it's in a very elevated state, but it's there. The other circumstance I was reminded of was the town of Ekachakra. When Nityananda was a young boy, as we all know the story, we recently spoke about this on his appearance day, that when Nityananda was a young boy, his mother and father, Padmavati and Hadai Oja, they had hosted one sannyasi. And this sannyasi had asked for the boon of their son to travel with him as his assistant. And the comparison is immediately given in all shastras, particularly in the Nityananda Charitamrita, and other shastras as well. The comparison is given to Dasarath Maharaj when his boys Ram and Bharat were asked for traveling with Valmiki. And so that example is there, and he took that example, Hadai Oja, and he agreed, yes. It describes that the residents of Ekachakra, as the sannyasi and Nityananda were departing from the city limits, from the town, on the outskirts of the village, that the residents were running, no, wait, let Nittai stay, take my son instead, let Nittai stay. And that when these pleas fell on deaf ears and the two departed off into the horizon, that the city of Ekachakra was just thrown into the throes of separation. Everyone's appreciation of all the beauty of Ekachakra and all the opulence of Nittai's presence was completely lost.
very, very painful scenario. So we can imagine that the personalities such as Yudhishthira Maharaj and Arjuna, we're going to see soon. I'll get to that in a minute. But these personalities, such a difficult position, realizing that the departure of the Lord is imminent. You know, we are thrown into sad feelings of separation when we lose a Vaishnava unexpectedly. But imagine that you're expecting this to take place and then it finally does. So that's the mood of these particular few verses here today, that circumstances that indicate very inauspicious things are always going to surround us, and the only way we can elevate ourselves beyond them and out of their influence is by taking shelter in the process of devotional service. So that's the thought we can work on today. Storyline for tomorrow, Arjuna, that great lion amongst men, cries. Why does he cry? Tune in tomorrow. So, questions, comments, corrections, additions? Yes, Prabhuji.
While I was reading Ayodhya, Ramayana, when Lord Ram leaves with Lakshman, half of the cities goes along with him. Half the city
Lakshman,
goes along,
I said Bart, yeah, Lakshman, yeah, thank you.
And the whole city is deserted. Everyone is so unhappy. They are not really able to bear the separation from the Lord. And when he comes back, everyone is so joyful. Everyone is so happy. The whole city is decorated. It's such a wonderful pastime.
That's the flip side there, is that the Lord actually returns after 14 years in the forest. And this is the whole Diwali festival and, you know, big, big festive time. And everybody's very, very happy. Unfortunately, Lord Krishna is not going to return after this. We see this at the end of this. Anyone else? Any other points? Questions? Anything?
Earlier, we were reading that when Vidura told Dhritarashtra that he had to leave, and Yudhisthira was lamenting about his departure, and Narada Muni told him that he didn't have to, that his separation was due to, like, his feeling of separation was due to illusion. So I was thinking about that, and I guess it kind of relates a little bit to here. Like, where does that... like, when we think that separation from Krishna, is that also, like, based in an illusion? Like, in the service and separation that we see, like, these great personalities attain? And I don't know, is that also based from illusion?
There are two types of Maya. There's Mahamaya, and there's Yogamaya. Mahamaya refers to that great illusion, the illusion of this world. I'm this body, these are my associates, my family, blah, blah, blah. I've got this much acquisition, I've acquired this much, I'm the owner and proprietor of this, so on and so on and so on. And our activities and thoughts and realizations based on that are illusion, yes. Then you have what's called Yogamaya, that mystical illusion. And that's the illusion that the devotees of the Lord sometimes appear to be under. Either in the Lord's pastimes here in this world, such as the classic example, Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna being illusioned. Arjuna, the greatest warrior among men, suddenly, oh, I can't fight. You know? It's like you don't expect it. He's trained for this his whole life. And he gets onto the front lines of the battle. And, I don't know. Maybe not. You know, you don't expect that. So how is that possible? So this is what's known as the Yogamaya. This is an illusion that he's put under for the sake of the Lord's pastime of speaking Bhagavad Gita. So, this is what's going on with Yudhishthira. Yudhishthira is not an illusion living entity. Yudhishthira is one of the intimate personal associates of the Lord that comes here at the time of the Lord for fulfilling his pastimes. So, therefore, these illusions that appear there, these are for the purpose of helping us gain some realization. Now, in addition to that, you've got then Mother Jasoda. Mother Jasoda is completely under the illusion that Krishna's her baby. This is my little boy. If I don't have, Krishna, and if he doesn't come in and I don't feed him, if I don't take the cow urine and put the different tilak places and sprinkle, then all the demons will have, like that. This is the great mystical illusion of devotion, of love. That's the illusion we aspire to be under. We don't want to be free from that illusion. We're seeking to be free from this other kind of illusion. So, and the way we learn this is by these examples in the Bhagavatam, where great devotees manifest that type of circumstance, so that we can learn from it, experience that.